Aloha, this is Catherine Cruz. Thanks for joining us here on The Conversation, Hawaii Talks. This morning we hear from the governor as we work to recover from the recent storms. Tax deadlines have been extended for those affected by the disaster, and more aid is on the way for businesses. We get the latest from state transportation officials on the price tag for reducing the rockfall risk at Waimea Bay. And we hear from the Navy's new Rear Admiral tasked with this next phase of dismantling the Red Hill Fuel Storage Facility and reopening the Halawa Aiea water shaft that was shut down after fuel contaminated our drinking water. And we talk about historic structures and the need for workforce development, growing skills in a high-demand area. This is The Conversation on Hawaii Public Radio. I'm Catherine Cruz. This morning, we checked in with Governor Josh Green. Since our last conversation with him, President Donald Trump has signed a major disaster declaration to aid in recovery efforts from the recent severe storms. It includes a three-month extension to file federal income taxes for affected individuals and businesses. There will also be a break for the state filing deadline as well. Here's Governor.
We've come through the worst of the storm, and I'm grateful for that. The first two Kona lows caused over $1 billion of combined damage and loss for the state. So in order to get recovery going, I've authorized $175 million in state funds for the immediate recovery by lifting restrictions on our budget that come at the end of the year. And then we also got the good news that we got the major disaster declaration from the administration, which I fought pretty hard for, so that now we'll get up to 75% of shared recovery or reimbursement for anything that we do on basically public assistance and individual assistance so people can really recover. But look, it takes time. I am grateful to the president's administration for deciding that they're going to support Hawaii like we had good support, bipartisan support during the wildfires. It's a very slow process. So we're doing some things to kind of give people a break. For example, this week is tax week, right? So people's state taxes would be due next week. If they'd like an extension because the storm caused them to lose paperwork or their computer or important information, they can have it. So all they have to do is go over to our State of Hawaii Department of Taxation website, DoTax, and they file a one-page form or one-and-a-half-page form. It's quick, and they'll get an extension until July 20th, so for 3 months. That way, any penalties and interest can be waived, and people can just have a break. And I got the federal government through the disaster declaration to also give people a three-month extension over to July 8th for their federal taxes. So most residents and businesses are statewide, extended, just so people can have a little breathing room because it's going to take some time to recover and, people are hurting. So as of yesterday, in my cabinet meeting, 120 people had filed for that extension. I'm sure we're approving them all or virtually all. And all people have to do is go to, I think it's hitax.hawaii.gov. They can fill out that form, just file that and get an extension if you need some time, because we've been through different tragedies and disasters. Of course, the fire, this flood, there are a lot of challenges with COVID, and people deserve a break if they've gone through a lot. Some people are tending to their family that may live in the flood zone. Just say it. Or if you obviously had direct losses completely, we understand. And then there's other things I'm going to do directly. First, we had applications for farms that lost a lot, they had mud covering up all the land, lost some of their seedlings. So the first 330 were approved, and I then realized there were 1,700 applications. So we just approved all of them. It's a modest amount, but that's a $2.5 million appropriation, which I do expect very likely to get reimbursed by the Department of Ag. I spoke with Secretary of Ag, Brooke Rollins, and she was very, very friendly with me and said they wanted to help extra for Hawaii. So that's the kind of thing that we're doing. We're also going to do business grants, $5,000 or $10,000 for affected businesses, depending on their size. That'll come out, I think, in the next week, the details. And that's so people can just cover their lease for this tough month. We are encouraging travelers to come back and visit the North Shore and other parts of Hawaii. But to be frank, I've seen pictures of empty parking lots. It's been pretty ghost townish in a lot of the areas where people are recovering for obvious reasons, because people are just getting their feet back under them. But this should help. And that's a $5 million program. I know for some, $5 million sounds like a lot, but for a statewide program where you get thousands of people, it actually goes real fast. So I want people to get that going. And then we can do the much larger recovery as we get you know, the schools repaired. We had $173 million of damage to schools. The first $50 million will come out of that kind of that early appropriation I made. And then over time, hopefully all by the start of next school year, we have the schools that were harmed or damaged back in good working order. The biggest challenge will be Kona Waena that really got destroyed.
Well, you know, we're fortunate that we're in the legislative process now and that, you know, we've gotten this designation to help us with the planning just to see this through.
The timing is good for us. The legislators have been great. You know, I so appreciate the finance and the Ways and Means Chair leaning in and asking what we need to help the people of Hawaii. A special kudos should go to Representative Quinlan, whose district really took the heaviest hit. And he's been working like 20 plus hours a day, making sure that we have recovery programs in place. We also are going to buy that dam. And I know that that has been a questionable or controversial acquisition for some. But when you look at what the consequences of dam failure would be for Wahiawa, it would be beyond catastrophic. If that dam ever went down, we would lose all the houses on the other side of the spillway and the dam. So we have to be able to control that. So right. They are appropriating the asked for money. And we would then try to turn that into a profit for us because we'll do hydropower over time. And we'll do more ag in that region because we'll have, you know, total control of the waters. So I will do my best to work out a reasonable deal with Dole and have some support for remediation. But some things you just have to take responsibility for. And it was the dam, honestly, that kept us up late at night.
Yes.
So that's what we have to do.
And then,
there's a lot of work to do, you know, but we're learning.
And then, you know, on this flooding issue, I know that Honolulu Civil Beat had a story about the flood designation at the Waiau power plant and how that might affect Hawaiian Electric's plan to move ahead with the renovations and the upgrades. What are your thoughts on that?
Yeah, you know, I'm not an engineer, so, you know, I'll leave that to Tico and others to sort out. I don't know what the overall risk is. Apparently, there's not been a flood there for over 100 years, so that's good news. But on the flip side, we just had a 500-year storm, and things are changing from a climate impact, you know, consideration. So we have to be safe. Let me say this about energy. I want to move the state forward. We are kind of stuck a little bit in a rut. I'm an absolute and total supporter of renewables, and we should max renewables constantly. And solar, wind, geothermal come to mind. The challenge is that if we don't update our power plants, we're going to continue to see these double-digit increases in cost, and people just can't afford it anymore. So the idea to just layer in, as just one of all of the different energy options, layer in some LNG, in my mind, and based on the study, which they're now amending to make sure that they're good and accurate, is sensible. We see what's happening, right? Our power plants are too old, cost billions of dollars to improve them. So I have this company that has reached out to us. It's in good standing. It's probably in the best standing in all of Japan. That's JERA. They want to invest $2 billion or more into Hawaii. The president has cut a deal to have Japan invest $550 billion into America. So this is an opportunity for us to have $2 billion of investment and in turn to lower energy costs by as much as 20%. I know some people don't like the idea of still using any fossil fuel. I get that. I even sued the fossil fuel companies. And we won that suit just a couple days ago. But right now, the idea of continuing to rely on oil from places like Libya or worry about what happens in the Middle East when you have a war with Iran, it's just insanity. So diversifying our energy portfolio to ultimately get to full renewables, which would be hydrogen in addition to solar, in addition to geothermal, makes sense. And I'm just not going to be a governor that sits on my butt and doesn't do something when I can try to make things more affordable. I think plus oil stinks. You know, using crude from the Middle East is bad. And prices went up 40% with this one somewhat ill-advised war. So I think it is important to be open-minded and to have solutions. And so I do definitely push back against people who say it can only be solar or it can only be wind, because we have to be more thoughtful.
On the issue of climate change, I know that, you know, there was a win in court the other day to strike down the lawsuit that the Trump administration filed against state of Hawaii.
Yeah, we won. That lawsuit was not very well thought out. And the truth is, we've been stepping into the fray. You know, we settled the Navahini lawsuit in partnership with that group of 15 young environmental leaders. And that decision I made that other governors before me refused to make was to demonstrate our, you know, our trust and belief that the young generation is correct, that climate is being affected by the excessive use of oil. Having said that, we do have to be sensible and bridge the gap, because I can't just flip the switch and tomorrow use biofuels. We just don't have enough, and the machinery is not fully in place. So it has to be a pragmatic process. But yes, we fought that lawsuit. I'm grateful that we won. And it gives us, you know, again, we're getting good marks on environment in general. We passed the green fee so that we have climate impact. We settled with the Navajine youngsters. But at the same time, I also want to be reasonable, because the federal government is not going to do any extra support for renewables for these years that the current administration's in there. And I can't just like let 4 years pass without trying to help our people, because right now it really does come down to affordability for most of our constituents, our citizens. They can't afford another $500 per family per year, which is what's going to happen if we don't do something on energy, and in this case, some LNG. But again, the misunderstanding from a lot of people has been that we couldn't possibly afford it or do it quickly because it's too costly. What they just didn't know is that I have $2 billion mm-hmm. coming from JIRA, and we expect probably $2 billion in the form of loans and grants from the federal government to support it. So right off the bat, I've been able to structure a partnership that will benefit the people in Hawaii and gradually get us off of traditional oil.
That was Governor Josh Green, who we spoke with this morning.
Support for HPR comes from Zippy's, celebrating 60 years of serving the community local-style foods, and being a place where family and friends can meet and share bentos, saimin, or their own idea of island comfort meals.
You know, tomorrow marks a week since two boulders as large as cars rolled down the hillside near Waimea Bay. It was fortunate that no one was hurt. Crews have been assessing the risk of the rock slide, and it turns out it may cost upwards of $20 million to minimize the hazard to motorists traveling on Kamehameha Highway. That's the latest, according to State Transportation Director Ed Sniffen. He spent the week out in the field. We caught up with him yesterday afternoon. Sniffen was working at DOT when rock slides closed off Kamehameha Highway 20 years ago, and a temporary access had to be constructed at Waimea Bay. We talked to him about reducing the risk to the general public.
Absolutely huge. And from our perspective, just we feel really lucky that nobody got killed. 9-foot diameter boulder that came down, followed by a small one at 6 feet, could have easily hurt or killed somebody. Very lucky that nothing happened. We made sure we shut down the roadway as quickly as possible to make sure nobody else was put at risk. Cleared the slopes of all the loose boulders that we found up there, another 16 or so. And then made sure that we kept a single lane access to that area to protect everybody going through.
16 boulders you had to take out after that?
Yeah, and that's not all of them either. There's significant size boulders up on the hill now. What normally happens when we have these periods of heavy rain, the clinker material or soil material that supports these boulders gets saturated, of course. When it weakens, these boulders come down. Once one comes down, there's a bunch of them nested boulders in those areas that are all destabilized. What we also see is a couple of days after the storm has been done, when the material starts drying out and getting more brittle, more boulders get destabilized. So we expect to see more boulders that we're going to have to take down over the next couple of days.
And I understand that you folks are having to divert some netting or some material for another project just to make sure we could reduce the risk to the general public as you work on the fixes.
Absolutely. I really appreciate Mayor Richard Bisson. They were doing a project with our contractor on Maui, and they had 100,000 square feet of this netting material that we're going to use. In order for us to get this material, it's a 2 to 3 month order and lead time. We let them know that we had an area that we need to secure sooner rather than later, and Mayor Bisson thankfully said, hey, just take the material we have, we'll order now and make sure we're in line for the next piece. So huge shout out to Mayor Bisson and huge mahalo to him for working with us to make sure we can get this area secured and open sooner rather than later.
And so what's the message you want to underscore? Because this fix is going to take a while and you're going to have to contraflow.
So the message to the public, we were lucky. We were extremely lucky that nobody died. We have the opportunity now to make sure that we can take care of all risks on this slope at this time. Over the next 4 months, we'll be draping about 200,000 square feet, about 550 lineal feet of hillside to ensure that anything that comes down in the future will never impact that road again. We're also putting up another 500 feet of impact fencing on the Haliva side of the slope to ensure that even on the flatter portion, if anything comes down, it'll be captured. So once we're done, no one will have to worry about anything coming from the Mauka side again. It's going to be significant. What the public should also understand is we have to do this project, regardless of whether we do it now or do it in the future. We're doing it as an emergency project now so we can move forward as quickly as possible. That means in 4 months, we can get this project done. Had we done this at a normal project time frame, we probably would close this roadway down for intermittently for 2 years.
Wow.
So we can move a lot faster now because of the emergency procedures.
And this isn't the only affected area, you know, traversing the tunnels over the Pali, major work over there as well. I know the lights have been out in the tunnels. I think they're back on now, but it was pretty sketchy during those storms.
Oh, definitely. Especially with these three back-to-back storms. The worst thing that can happen in the past was we get a small storm to pre-wet things and a larger storm followed it. What we had this time were three large storms that our system just wasn't set up to weather. We saw some breakdown from the first Kona low. We made sure we made adjustments before the second and more adjustments before the third, just to ensure that we can be more and more resilient as we went through. And now coming out of it, we're making sure that we make further adjustments. What we found is that there's a lot of stream areas that haven't been maintained for a long time. There's a lot of complex jurisdictions that come with streams, some owned by the city, some by the state as crossing jurisdictions. Some are private. In the past, everybody would stay within their jurisdiction. Now, the governor asked us to be very aggressive in ensuring that we clear these streams. So we're working, the DOT is working with these jurisdictions to make sure we can clear out all these areas, not just under a bridge, not just in the surrounding area, but as far up as necessary to ensure that we can minimize the potential for flooding and impacts to housing and lives in the future. So we're learning. We're making sure that we're getting better at those things. For slopes, we're making sure that we're pre-assessing slopes and pre-scaling and clearing material before large storms come through. In cases like this, though, we don't know what's going to be destabilized. So we'll take the opportunity now to ensure that we can protect ourselves from those slope falls, no matter what falls in the future, by putting up netting or other impact fencing.
Any other high-risk areas across the state that you want to underscore?
Yeah, so we're still working on the three gulches on Hamakua Coast, on the Big Island. Want to make sure that we stabilize those areas and protect our public from those areas as much as possible. There's always tree falls that we have in those areas that we want to make sure that we minimize as we move forward. So putting up the right types of vegetation in those portions are important. Hana Highway is always an issue. We're looking at how we can put up erosion control matting with those very steep slopes on the Mauka and the Makai sides of the road, or uphill and downhill sides, to minimize any kind of impacts that the public would have there as well. Those are all the different portions that we need to consider. And of course, Hanle Hills or the Hanle side and the slopes that we have going out to Haena. I want to make sure that we can stabilize things over time.
I know when we talked to Mayor Derek Kawakami, his concern was for the abezia trees. And when I saw all those abezias that were down near the H3 here on Oahu, I was just amazed. And I don't know. I know DOT did try and cut down some of the ones that were really close, I think out in central Oahu, some years ago. But we were just very fortunate that no one got whacked by those trees coming down.
Oh, I totally agree. Those are the worst types of trees. They grow 5 feet a year like weeds. They propagate pretty quickly. And even when we start cutting them down, they come back very quickly. So we're making sure that we clear them from our right-of-way, push them back as far as possible, but also clear them from any power lines that could be in the area. We own the roads, but we also depend on power to make sure things are operational with our signals and our lights to keep everybody safe.
That was State Transportation Director Ed Sniffen talking about the fix for high hazard rockfall risk in the Waimea area on Oahu.
So Support for HPR comes from the Olson Trust, with a mission to support growing sustainable agriculture, protecting natural resources, and investing in Hawaii's people. OlsonTrust.com.
The military held an open house event at the Pearl City Country Club last night. It was to give the public a chance to talk face-to-face with subject matter experts about the status of dismantling the Red Hill Underground Fuel Facility. On hand was Rear Admiral Lester Ortiz. He's the new deputy commander of the Navy Closure Task Force in charge of this latest phase. He took over in January. Rear Admiral Ortiz is a Navy CB who hails from Puerto Rico. He says he's keenly aware of the connection between Aina and its people and the responsibility to see this project through safely. The Navy would like to reopen the Halaba Aea water shaft. It was closed following the discovery of fuel in the Navy's drinking water system, which sickened military families and civilians some 4 years ago. It forced the decision to drain the tanks and dismantle the pipes. Here's Admiral Ortiz.
I am native from Puerto Rico. I have lived in the island for many years, and I understand the stewardship of the land and the resources, how important it is, especially in an island when you have limited resources.
And your background is with the Seabees?
Yes, I'm a civil engineer out of the Civil Engineer Corps. I'm a CB.
Why is that so important in the context of shutting this facility down and taking it apart?
The Red Hill facility is unique in nature. It's a huge engineering project, and definitely engineering background is required to understand from the facilities perspective as well from the environmental perspective. That's where the naval facilities engineers typically do. We focus on environment and also in facilities.
And so has there been anything that surprised you when you first set foot at Red Hill, knowing the history and what needs to get done to complete the mission?
Yeah, it was very impressive to see the type of facility. It's unique, it's huge, and it was built so many years ago that it presents many challenges for the different regulations that we have that typically are set for something smaller in scale or different. So it represents a lot of technical challenges.
And so what's the, I guess, the timetable? There's talk of opening up the shaft again, and, you know, we understand that hopefully you folks would like to be able to achieve that at some point this year?
Yes, we are pursuing the opening of Navy Aea Halaba shaft, especially after the water report that came out of EPA, and we should have that done at some point early during the year, and continue pursuing the next shaft for probably next year at some point.
And I know that the EPA, you know, held a webinar this week just to talk about the report and to get the information out there for people to hopefully have some sense of confidence that the water's all clear.
Yes, we have a webinar, and EPA hosted that webinar, and it presented data from at least 2022 up to now, and presenting that there's no fuel contamination in the water.
And so I guess what else would you like to underscore as we work through this process? Because I know there have been a number of changes that were implemented. I know that the Navy's not appearing at the CRI meetings, and the FTAC meetings are more in the daytime now.
Yeah. We will continue pursuing the communication path. We want to continue being transparent. And for this year, our community engagement plan is to focus on the drinking water and the users, go directly to them. So we are planning to participate in specific events where we can have full access to them, and they are open for questions. But nevertheless, events like CWARM and FTAC and any other like this open house that we're having, and eventually a town hall that we will have further during the year, is open for anybody from the community to come and ask questions.
And I know during these times, a lot of attention is on the Middle East and the volatility of fuel and oil, and thinking now that we have closed Red Hill, we don't have access to, you know, all that fuel for the military's purposes. I don't know, does it make you pause and reflect on the security of the Pacific region?
I'm not in the mission about the fueling and supporting fueling for the fleet. I am more focused on closing the facility right now. And because that is our mission, we focus into the environmental side and making sure that people understand what is happening. But we are not, at least the task force is not looking into the opportunities for how fuel will be supported in other means.
Okay. And then anything else you want to underscore just about the timeline for removing the pipes and reopening the shaft?
Well, we continue looking into completion of the tank cleaning. We finally will start cutting the pipes, and we still foresee hopefully by 2028 we will be very advanced in all these processes, and we'll have the environmental site assessment, which is really what we want to achieve during this mission, just to then explore what the mitigation plan will be on the environmental side.
And then anything more on the future of the tanks?
I have nothing right now for the future of the tanks. We continue the focus on making sure that the cleaning process is complete and that we are setting everything in motion. The tanks will be clean and close in place.
Okay, and then we haven't had any incidents that we know of anyway. Up to this point, everything has been according to plan.
Yes, there's no more fuel. The only thing that we are doing right now is cleaning the sludge that typically is left on the tanks, and that's part of the cleanup we have done. We are in about 10 tanks that we are in the process of cleaning. Few of them are already completely clean, and there's a minimal amount of fuel that is fully accounted for.
That was Rear Admiral Lester Ortiz with the Navy Closure Task Force. On hand at the open house event held at the Pearl City Country Club last night was the Environmental Protection Agency. It held a webinar this week on its latest report on the system water quality, and that webinar is expected to be posted online at some point. And we hope to hear more from the EPA next week. So stay tuned.
Support for HPR comes from NAREIT Hawaii, which supports nonprofits committed to helping families of agricultural workers and retirees with affordable housing, such as the Kunia Village Development Corporation, NAREITHawaii.com.
You know, we often hear about the need for skilled workers in our community, from doctors to nurses, but there's also a shortage of craftsmen. Today we hear from the Historic Hawaii Foundation about the need for carpenters who are skilled at working on historic structures, in particular, wooden windows from a different era. Kirsten Faulkner joined us recently, along with contractor Alan Shintani. He is leading the charge to train a workforce and is a key driver of classes offered to those willing to learn a new skill to help meet a growing demand of expertise when it comes to historic homes. Shintani has worked on the Royal Mausoleum Chapel at Mauna Ala, as well as projects in the Pearl Harbor Historic District. A two-day workshop about window repairs kicked off today at Maui College. Faulkner starts us off.
Alan came to Historic Hawaii Foundation and said he's seeing this real need for skilled carpentry and master carpentry to actually repair and preserve and restore windows specifically, but all kinds of historic characteristics of buildings as well. And what can we do? And that was the start of it, really. And so we did our first workshop in 2021. It had originally been planned for 2020, but during the pandemic, we had to delay and re-scope that a bit. That was on Oahu in Ewa Villages. And then we did another one at Kokea on Kauai at the Civilian Conservation Corps camp there that was very well received. Then we came back to Oahu and did another one at the Building Industry Association in Waipahu. And then this one that's coming up will be in Wailuku and Kahului on Maui. So each one has had its own focus, but it's all been from the perspective of how can we build preservation trades workforce that can help people save these historic properties in a very skillful and ongoing way. And related to that, of course, is taking care of the historic properties, but also that workforce development and that job training aspect and the economics that come along with that.
And then Alan, jump in here, you know, because really you want to grow the pool of people, of skilled artisans, really, you know, who know what they're doing, who appreciate, you know, how these structures were built many years ago, right?
Yes, of course. You know, there's a big shift in the industry, in construction, and everything is being pushed on new construction. They're teaching new methods and new materials coming out. the newer products, how to install it and how to work with it. I think, but in the process, they've kind of dropped the repair and the remodeling part of the work in the older homes and the care and the maintenance for these homes. So there's a, I guess, a small disconnect in the industry right now where less and less of the tradespeople are being taught how to do maintenance and repairs.
And so, you know, in these sessions that you offer, you're looking for what, everybody from just someone who's got an interest in this area to the skilled carpenters who are learning another part of the craft?
Well, it takes years to develop a craftsman. But when it comes to these older homes, I mean, a lot of these repairs can be done by homeowners themselves if they want to repair their houses.
And so homeowners are welcome.
Yes, they're welcome.
Yeah, and so tell us about the classes. Like, how intensive are they?
Well, we hope that a lot of these students that are coming in have some background in repairing their homes and basic hand tools that they're going to need. And we just teach a small portion here about this. In this class is window repairs and repairing a glass pane and re-glazing the windows to re-waterproof the windows and glass.
And some of these systems, right, they've got, what is it, sashes? So, you know, they work differently than some of the vinyl windows that you often see.
Right. We'll talk about those. And a lot of times the students will ask us during the class about their particular windows. So a lot of them have counterweights that they use. But there's also springs that are on the newer windows that needs to be changed as well. And it depends on the window that they have. It could be alternate materials.
And then, Kirsten, talk about what else goes into repairing these windows. I mean, you know, maybe there's certain types of, I don't know, you call it millwork, right? Depending on the era that the homes are built in.
One of the things we'll be doing in the class and that we've done in the previous curriculum is to give a overview of what are some of the architectural types or the characteristics that are associated with particular periods in Hawaii's history. And these double-hung wooden windows are very classic to especially that plantation era, you know, from about the 1880s to about the 1950s. And it's very much part of the sense of place, the sense of culture that we see in these, especially older plantation towns. So we'll talk a bit about how did Hawaii's sense of place and architectural styles evolve? What role did windows and doors and hardware and siding and roof lines, you know, what are the kit of parts that all together give you this sense of Hawaii's architecture? And then within that, the windows themselves are so iconic, they're so characteristic that we want people to understand how they work, you know, what are the pieces? What are the sash? What are the operable pieces? Do they open and close from top to bottom or in and out? Or are they fixed in place? You know, we'll talk about those pieces. Alan has this wonderful, we call it the puzzle window, where the pieces come apart and then go back together. And so you can see how they all fit. And so having that basic understanding of where we're coming from, and then why is it important to fix them as opposed to just take the whole thing out, throw it away, install some, you know, vinyl window that doesn't have that kit of parts. So we'll talk about the craftsmanship and the sustainability and reuse of materials and having that feel for it. And then we'll teach them how. So not just being well-intentioned, but to actually have the skills to do that. Each step builds towards the next one. And then people who already know how to do some of this, it'll be a refresher, but other people will be brand new for them.
Yeah, I mean, if you've got a trained carpenter, and like I said, he then can expand his knowledge, right, about how to work on historic homes or historic properties, I mean,
exactly.
Then you're more saleable, right?
Exactly, yes.
And so what are you seeing out there? You know, because we often hear, like in the construction business, that we don't have enough workers.
We don't have enough workers, and there's a big need for a lot more. And we're not teaching the whole class. I mean, it'll take, again, years to develop some craftsmen. But basically just an introduction to an alternate of replacing these windows by, showing them that repairs are possible and they're not very difficult.
No, I have some windows. They're actually stained glass windows from a place in, I believe it was, it's St. Louis, a place called Fallens. And it was kind of like Reuse Hawaii, where they took apart a lot of these old historic buildings in downtown St. Louis. And, you know, you can purchase these things and they're works of art.
Yeah. Repurposed windows are getting back and much more popular. Yes.
And so when you, this notion of replacing windows on a historic home, I mean, I don't know what kinds of things, you know, Reuse Hawaii gets these days, if they've got something similar that might work in your home. I don't know.
Well, one of the first things we look at is, how do you describe the building, whether it's a home or something else? And part of that is, what kinds of windows are there? Where are they located? What are their dimensions? You know, how wide are they? How many panes of glass do they have in each of the sash? And so it's not like you can just take out one kind and put back anything. It needs to match. And so a big part of this is the review and the assessment. So we'll be talking about how do you document some of these properties, and then what do you look for? So if you have a double hung window that has four panes of glass over, you know, the lower sash has one pane of glass, that's a 4:1, then that's what you'd replace it with. You wouldn't replace that with a 6:2 or something like that. So we'll be talking about how to do that assessment. Repair is always the first choice. If there's a simple way to rehang and rebalance the weights, or to replace a broken pane of glass, or to make it weatherproof with a certain putty or glazing treatment, that's first choice. Second choice would be to replace it with something that is the same style or design, you know, and third choice might be to just custom make a new one that would fit. So you wouldn't just go to, you know, a vintage parts store and just buy something, right? You wouldn't want to go through that assessment first.
Anything else that you want to add in here, Ellen, just about the need just to grow the workforce here? Because I imagine these homes are getting older and the need is great.
The need is great, yes. A lot of the working crew has, I guess, aged. They're looking to retire or they're retired. And there hasn't been a big push to reestablish some kind of a replacement of these workers.
We have been hearing from Alan Shintani and Kirsten Faulkner. They were talking about a shortage of skilled craftsmen to work on historic structures. Look for links on our website later today. The Historic Hawaii Foundation says reach out if you're interested in future training. And that does it for today's show. Thank you for spending time with us on The Conversation. I'm Catherine Cruz. Now back to John and Belinda at the pitch table.